Stand Up with Pete Dominic. With Pete Dominic. On Indy, Sirius XM 104.
Barry Ritholtz is set to join us any minute, but of course he's running late. Barry Ritholtz, it's been far too long since Barry's been on the show. It's not because we haven't invited him. You know, he's at a very busy end of summer, and he's reformatted his entire company and website. He is the founder of the Big Picture blog at Ritholtz.com. He's the author of Bailout Nation, How Greed and Easy Money Corrupted Wall Street and Shook the World Economy. And he just storms in here like a tornado. And he is here, and everybody loves at Ritholtz on the Twitter. How are you, sir? Welcome to the conversation. Thank you for being here.
Pretty damn good. How are you?
You are good. Well, at least somebody is. Are you not worried about your entire business if we default on our debt?
I don't worry about things that are outside of my control.
Okay.
Not to get all zen on you.
No, that's all right.
Focus on what's within my control, which is, you know, what I eat, the clothes I wear, how I behave, how I comport myself, and how I anticipate and respond to insanity in D.C.
Well, that is a good attitude, and I'll give you that.
Healthy.
Okay, so what do you think happens if there is not a deal by tomorrow, which is when Jacob Lew, the Treasury Secretary, who represents the Treasury Department, whose job it is, to pay our bills. He sees the money coming in and going out, right? He writes a check.
CFO of America.
Right. And he says tomorrow's the deadline.
Right.
And so there's some debate in terms of how much money we're taking in and how much we have going out and so on. But from my understanding, people in your world, investors, the key there is confidence. And if confidence is lost in markets, it generally equals disaster. And so we're seeing confidence being lost, are we not?
It's a little more nuanced than that.
And the American Treasury and the American T-bills.
So when you talk about confidence, you're talking really about three separate things. The first thing is confidence of the consumer. We already see a number of automakers saying that concern about what's going to happen is impacting consumer confidence, is impacting Hyundai, which has been one of the hottest car companies of the past 5 years, the only car company that actually grew through the Great Recession, is saying they expect to see a 10% impact on sales.
What about real estate?
Why is this? Real estate is a little more nuanced because
if I'm buying a house right now, if I'm closing in the next couple of weeks,
what do you care? What do you care about?
I might be worried about it.
Well,
I might say, you know what? Let me wait. I might not be really concerned, but I might say, let's wait for
it's
a couple
back of
more
your head.
Weeks.
It probably has a bigger impact
transaction
on people.
Might not occur.
Well, no, those transactions are by contract. They'll occur. The bigger impact is more attenuated in that, hey, we were going to go out and look at houses this weekend, but all this craziness.
Or cars. Maybe holiday shopping season,
right,
sir.
That's the first impact on confidence is consumers. Now, let me also point out the other side of that argument is, the countryside is littered with the bodies of economists who forecast the American consumer.
No, it's not. They're all on CNBC. Continue.
But,
no, it's not.
But the reality is it takes a whole lot to really shake consumer confidence. But that doesn't mean around the edges you can't have a impact that's actually somewhat significant. So that's number one. The second and perhaps more longer lasting impact of confidence. Look, America has what Charles de Gaulle called an exorbitant privilege. The dollar is the reserve currency of the world. And every time there's a crisis, the safe haven, the stable place to hide has been the U.S. Treasury. The essential insanity of what's been going on in D.C., and I am certainly avoiding the false equivalencies and saying a pox on both of their houses. This is an internecine war within the Republican Party for the soul of the Republican Party by some very hardline far-right conservatives and the increasingly powerless moderate conservatives.
If you want to call them moderate.
By today's standards. Look, I grew up a Jacob Javits Republican, which is a liberal Northeastern Republican. That now puts me somewhere to the far left of the spectrum. But that used to be the center of the political spectrum in the United
States.
I just think that
our spectrum is so you know, it's just so skewed. Yes, you have
it's warped.
You have to put someone on the right that's anti-gay marriage. You have to put them on there, but you could easily argue that the marriage equality is the most conservative idea in the world. It's just that we've allowed the frame.
No, it's not. It's a progressive.
It's freedom.
The idea.
No, it's freedom.
The
it's freedom,
idea
it's
that
liberty,
people
the
have
liberty
civil rights. Has somehow become a leftist
right, but that's not, but,
view.
But specifically,
it wasn't always that
I
way.
Know, but it's, listen, specifically, if you're talking about freedom and liberty and the government not intervening, the idea that you can marry whatever consenting adult you want is the quintessential conservative
that's
idea.
That's a libertarian
However,
position. In fact, the fascinating hangover from what has been called the Reagan Coalition, which is to take the tax conservatives, the deficit hawks, the libertarians, and the religious right, and mash them together, is to take two groups, or within that are two groups who have wildly conflicting views. You're pointing out the libertarians, who believe when it comes to things like gambling and regulation and abortion and birth control, the government, and drugs for that matter, the government has no business intervening. The libertarian view is, you're an adult, if you want to smoke pot, or have an abortion, or gamble away your rent money,
or get
take
a hooker,
heroin,
or take heroin,
right.
Or do all of those things together.
Right. That's a hell of a weekend. You basically should be free to do that, and the government has no business saying that. That's a libertarian position. But at the same time, you have the Reagan Coalition included the religious right. Remember that whole crowd, which has made abortion a major plank of the Republican Party. So the Republicans are now a party,
I'm just saying,
a coalition
what is,
that's falling apart.
Yeah, what is necessarily how I'm defining things in the framing? Would you say, Barry Ritholtz, that Peter King, who is you're from Long Island,
he's from Suffolk County.
Okay,
he's way out.
But
east.
Nonetheless, would you generally up until now have considered him moderate?
No, he's always been a conservative Republican.
Right, and he's the
but
guy.
But he's been
right
outflanked
now.
By some of the
right. So that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Framing. Peter King has always been considered a very conservative
right.
Republican and never saw an armed conflict that he didn't support.
That's a militant. And understand, now we start to get into nuances. You see the Ron Paul school of libertarianism, which essentially is isolationist and says, why are we spending trillions of dollars defending other countries, right. intervening where we don't belong, sticking our nose in places that – now, I don't agree with everything Ron Paul says by a long stretch – but when you look at how large the defense budget is and you look at the U.S. basically acting as peacekeeper in Europe and essentially being the Defense Department for Japan, you have to wonder, hey, this guy has a point. Why are we spending so much money there while we have so many needs that are unmet in the United States, whether it's infrastructure or healthcare or education or what have you?
Not that Ron Paul wants government to be spending any money or intervening on things like infrastructure, but hold on, I may have misrepresented.
You can't get there until you make – look, the U.S. defense spending is equal to the next 20 countries combined. Stop and think about how insane that is. And so until the U.S. is only equal to the next 10 countries combined, there's not going to be any money for these right. other things, whatever you may choose them to be, whether it's building new highways or rerouting the internet or just
universal pre-K,
just hardening our electrical grid, which is completely vulnerable to attack. From a national security standpoint, we should move a couple of billion dollars from the Defense Department. We don't need a 13th or a 14th carrier.
You're making
group.
Far too much sense. Barry Ritholtz.
Basically, we should
improve our, yes,
yeah.
That would be a way
improve
to defend our
health
country.
And safety.
Yes. Barry
Crazy
Ritholtz though. Is here. The Big Picture blog, Ritholtz.com. He's a finance guy. He's an economics guy. He writes a column for the Washington Post. He does all kinds of
stuff. A renaissance
man.
A polymath.
He really is a renaissance
an
man in many ways.
Skittles he's a, player.
He's an equestrian. Barry he's also on Twitter, at Ritholtz. Okay, so yesterday about just before 5 o'clock, I got an update on Twitter from CBS News. Fitch puts United States AAA credit rating under review for a downgrade. I immediately tweeted without looking at markets or anything like that, the Dow. I immediately then tweeted, global markets just took a dump. Was I right?
The futures, which is the trading that takes place pretty much 24 hours, were pretty negative. until later in the evening when the rumors started coming out that, hey, it looks like there's some sort of Senate deal. If you look at how this has morphed over time, we must defund Obamacare or there will be no deal on the debt.
Right.
Then it moved from, well, we're not going to defund Obamacare, but we have to get rid of this medical devices tax, which will cost every man, woman, and child $60 per head. And then we moved against that, and then it eventually became, we must do something about some deficit at some point in the future, and there has to be some policy statement that's ambiguous. And now it's down to, we insist in both cream or skim milk in our coffee, and if we don't get that, we won't. You know, the whole process has just so radically changed the demands that this is going to end up being either a collapse or a complete and total retreat by the Tea Party. And it's a matter of time till we find out which one it exactly is.
Well, we'll see about that. Did my microphone just shut down? Did my entire no, just
all right,
my,
so
just
Pete
my
is gone, so I'm going to cover the
That'd
next
awesome.
2 hours.
It's
we'll
just my headphones?
Just chit-chat about some other more important stuff.
So, no, but, I mean, let's get back to Fitch, though.
All right.
What does Fitch's downgrade mean for our
this isn't
economy
a downgrade.
In our country?
What it is
it's not a downgrade.
It's an they put the outlook as negative. What that means is they're essentially saying, and I posted this on the blog shortly thereafter, in a phrase that I probably can't say on the air.
But go ahead. Well, you can say it on this channel. We're different now.
Oh, okay.
Be nice.
So USA's AAA rating placed on negative watch at Fitch. Quote, this is why you don't fuck around with the debt ceiling. Although
right.
Fitch continues to believe the debt ceiling will be raised soon, the political brinkmanship and reduced financing flexibility increases the risk of a U.S. default.
So,
in other words, by messing around with this, you're basically putting everybody else on notice that, hey, America isn't the bastion of stability, isn't the rational, mature nation that it has appeared to be. So even if this is all resolved, permanent damage has been done to the
well,
reputation
how come,
of the United
how
States.
Come back in 2011 during that debt ceiling fight, it was Standard & Poor's that actually downgraded our
That's
credit
right.
from AAA to AA? Is
they
right?
downgraded their rating, and in order, because there are three major rating agencies,
Standard
in order
and Poor's,
for it,
Fitch and Moody's?
And Moody's, uh-huh. correct. Standard & Poor in this actual building. We're in the McGraw-Hill
right, so
building.
Nobody cares
my...
about that. So it just
I
makes,
care
us,
about that.
Just makes us more of a terrorist target. Shut up. So let me ask you. Don't maybe not get too far in the weeds, but why would one credit ratings agency come up with one pretty drastic announcement and then the other two do not get on board?
Differences of opinion.
So, okay.
You're
so,
making
so,
a forecast about the future. Will the United States politicians grow up and learn to play nice? S&P essentially said, hey, these idiots have really jumped the shark and we think this is a permanent damage. And in fact, if you go back to what S&P wrote back then, it turned out to be pretty prescient in terms of I'm actually doing a search while we speak. S&P rating downgrade of U.S. When you go back and look at what they warned about, this sort of internecine warfare and political gamesmanship could ultimately lead to brinksmanship on debt ceiling. And it turned out that they appear to be right.
You're not – I mean – So if we let's say that we go past Barry, let's say that we go. This is going on. There's no agreement. Let's just say it's a hypothetical that we'll know the answer to tomorrow. So I shouldn't even waste time. Let's say we wake up Friday morning and we still have no agreement and we have not lifted the debt ceiling.
So then the question becomes: what sort of shell game is the government going to play?
Forget
in
that.
Order
what
to...
do markets? You're the. What do markets do?
I think markets take a big dump. They're down 500 points. I think they take.
When does this?
The comment I said a month ago was, if this goes on for 30 days, markets could be down 20-30%.
But who cares? Because they'll bounce back. So who cares?
Yeah.
So if I lose my entire.
And perversely, it would actually end up creating a buying opportunity, which is the markets have this perverse logic that is very counterintuitive. You know, in most of the world, when stuff goes on sale, you like it. In markets, when stuff goes up, people want to buy it. When it goes down, they hate it. They want to sell it. So you end up with this really counterintuitive hall of mirrors that up is down, good is bad. And so a sell-off would actually be an opportunity.
When do the Warren Buffett nuclear disaster warnings come true? And I mean, we have heard from some very credible sources on investment, on finance, that have said, you know, you've got, I think, Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein.
Still waiting for a credible voice on investment. Keep
credible
going.
In that what they control.
Right.
What the amount of capital. That
Congress. They control the Congress.
They control.
So Warren Buffett is a credible voice on investing.
Okay. But
Jamie Dimon is the most overrated banker. He's a bum.
I know, but
J.P. Morgan lost money because they've spent so much money on fines and lawyers.
I'm not.
Give me a different name.
Lloyd Blankfein and J.P. Morgan run Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. Jamie Dimon runs. And so they, by that, because of that, they have the ear of Congress because they donate so much to their campaigns. So that they're telling – I'm saying, Barry, you can,
so
you and I agree on them, but they are telling –
So you're raising a whole nother –
They're
really
telling Congress,
issue.
If you don't do this, we're screwed.
And
there's
being
been
ignored.
Many an article written that the business wing of the Republican Party, businesses are having very little
They've
influence.
Lost total control. The Tea Party is a renegade group of – look, one of the things the Republicans could always count on was the support of business. You had the Chamber of Commerce. Regardless of what you think of the National Chamber of Commerce, you could say they're evil, drunken pederasts. You can say all sorts of stuff about them. But they're you've said that to me off the air. But the reality is they're very influential, and they've had
I was talking about the Catholic Church, not the Chamber of Commerce.
It's so hard to keep them separate. But you've had by the way, you've had this Pope come out and say things.
Don't. Stay on target. Stay
you
on.
You have to. You.
Stay on
so
target.
When you
Luke.
Look at these, when you look at these so-called influential entities, from Lloyd Blankfein to the Pope, telling Congress, "Hey, you guys have to step up and do the right thing. Take your dispute at another point, but don't risk another financial catastrophe." It's fallen on deaf ears, and there is a much. So this is a longer conversation, and it's a 30,000-foot view. You're raising two issues. What happens on Friday if this default goes through? It's not like a light switch. It's more like a gradual process.
It's like the tide going in and out.
That's exactly right. The damage has already begun to be happening. So China, the single biggest holder of U.S. debt, $1.3 trillion of U.S. Treasury.
Let's call them... The single biggest investor, because I think it misleads a lot of people who don't understand that
they own
debt,
treasuries. They don't bonds.
That our debt is worth something.
That's
it
right.
Actually is an investment.
It's a AAA investment.
Anybody listening can invest and they can buy bonds, right?
That's correct. You can buy treasury
bonds. And then they'll
bonds.
Get money and it's a great safe investment for your retirement, for your kids' college.
It's safe. It's low yielding now because the Fed
you're not
going
to get a lot back, but you usually don't on a safe investment.
Well, no, you used to get.
I'll tell you.
Used
how
to get a lot
work.
More, and
you
it's...
listen. Sit back and listen.
Okay.
So I just
school
think,
me about investing.
I think it's. I just think it's misleading. Not misleading. I think people don't understand why China holds so much of our debt. Why they choose to do that.
Well, there's a couple of reasons.
Because
first,
it's a good investment. That's it.
Again, no, it's much more complicated.
It's leverage.
No,
it basically
keeps we're
their money.
Stop and think about this. Right. We're buying tons of stuff from China every year. We're buying literally. Trillions of dollars worth of goods from China, and we pay for it with dollars. So now China, we give them little pieces of paper that some people have claimed are worthless. They give us real goods, real services, real materials. Now that keeps their people employed, that keeps their factories humming, that keeps their ghost cities being built. And now China has all this cash. What do they do with it? Well, they could give it back to us in some way so we could keep buying stuff from them. And the way they do that is they go out and they buy all these bonds. Because, A, what else are you going to do with $1 trillion? There's no place else to put it. There is no other market that's broad and deep and liquid enough for all that money. And so not only do they get a place to put it where it will grow, however low the rates are, but they also get to recycle the bills back to
do
Uncle Sam, who then buy more crap and more iPods from China.
So, Barry, based on your demeanor and what you're saying – I would imagine that you're surprising me here and saying that, you know, defaulting on our debt, which technically is what's happening if we don't raise the debt ceiling tomorrow,
right?
is not that big of a deal.
No, it's a huge thing. It's
well, when does it become?
Thing.
When do all these predictions?
It's
these
not
doomsday
a light switch.
Predictions.
You have to understand how this works.
Yeah, okay, but when do these doomsday predictions come true? Because listen,
never. The doomsday predictions are always idiotic, and you can ignore those people with tremendous prejudice.
Warren Buffett is someone who
that's hyperbole. He's exaggerating, and I don't put Warren Buffett into the doomsday camp. The reality is simply this. Having the dollar as the reserve currency of the world is probably good for a couple of $100 billion a year in extra whatever. It keeps borrowing costs for U.S. consumers lower than it would be. It makes
when
the United
do we start?
States,
when do people, average ordinary Americans, start feeling the effect of not raising the debt ceiling? If they
this
raise
is a
the
process
debt ceiling
that will
next
happen
week,
over 10 or 20 years, if this is not a tomorrow thing. All right, what may happen?
All right.
So here's a worst-case scenario. The worst-case scenario
Wait, hold on.
Is,
you give me a worst-case scenario when we come back from a break. We got to take a quick break, and we'll come back. Barry Ritholtz is here, at Ritholtz on Twitter, the Big Picture blog. It's new and improved. Check it out. We'll be right back with Barry Ritholtz.
Stand up with Pete Dominic. You're listening to a radio bumper for a show. Now some music, then talking.
And we're back with Barry Ritholtz, at Ritholtz on Twitter. I'm good, Alfred. Everything's good. Thank you, buddy. You were talking about worst case scenario with debt ceiling, and that's where we had to take
Was
a break
I?
There. Yep.
Yes, worst case scenario. So the worst case scenario is the shell game of moving money around to figure out what you're going to pay exhausts its possibility, and a debt payment is due to the holders of U.S. bonds, and the U.S. does not have the legal authority to pay it because they've paid so many other things. By the way, before we get too far afield, recognize that the debt ceiling is a hyper-technical piece of legislation from the 30s that essentially says after Congress already approves what they're going to spend, right, they have this limit on debt. So Congress has effectively passed two conflicting pieces of legislation. Go spend all this money,
right,
but not more than this amount. But wait, you're telling me to go spend all this money? That's $11. You're saying not more than this amount is $10. It's in conflict. So in theory, it puts the president in a position where he has to either, A, choose which of these laws he wants to violate. The government can theoretically pay the debt and not default and say to Congress, you authorize the spending, I'm following what you told me to do, which was go spend this money. And the fact that you didn't authorize the ceiling is in conflict, and since you've created an ambiguity, I'm exercising my best judgment.
But that's it's still now illegal. Whatever he does, it'll
whatever
be illegal.
He yeah.
And
Congress,
then he can be impeached.
Congress has created a situation where that no matter what he does, he's violating a law of Congress.
Okay, so
let's say he
also
doesn't pay the interest on bonds. Let's say he defaults. The worst case scenario is there's a panic. People go to dump dollars and dump bonds. The value of the dollar falls 50%. Yields spike up to 10%. And the United States enters a crippling depression.
When could the soonest that could happen?
Monday. Sure.
For real, Monday?
Yeah. But I don't think that's a – I think that's a low probability outcome.
Isn't it also true
but it's
that while you could pay your debtors –
mm-hmm.
You could pay your debtors with what we're taking in. You could not also pay Americans. Is it? Is this true? Is this talking point I heard
you
a Democrat? I heard the Democrat versus Republican debate on congressman debate on it was Xavier Becerra versus Ted Yoho. I heard this on CNN. It was very interesting.
You who?
Doesn't matter.
Florida.
So, yes.
Right. Why do we get from Florida?
I don't know where the hell he's from. Listen.
Well, if he's insane, you got to assume Florida. That's a high pro. That's again. You're just playing the odds.
So basically, he said the Democrats said, "Yeah, you're choosing to pay China before you pay veterans and Social Security
and
recipients."
That's still technically
is that
a
true?
Well, you know,
we have enough to pay the people that we owe money to, in terms of that have invested in our debt. Those people, but we also owe money to veterans than federal employees and Social Security recipients. We will not have enough money to pay them, which would mean you're choosing to pay China before veterans. That's what Xavier Becerra.
So here's the problem with that.
Becerra.
The Treasury Secretary has stated that, you know, it's not like a family that's a little tight on money and has to figure out, do I pay Visa or MasterCard? Understand how complex the U.S. budget is and how automated much of the payments are. It's not like, all right, today we're going to pay China. All right, tomorrow we're going to pay Japan. All right, Thursday we're going to pay veterans. It's, hey, either the money is there or it's not. It's far too complex to just say, pay Visa, but not Macy's. It doesn't
so
work
that,
that
Democratic talking point is not really good.
So I'm not sure. I mean, you got to take what the Treasury Secretary, if we take what he says at face value, you really can't pick and choose because of the way the payment structure has been set up.
We're talking to Barry Ritholtz. We're talking about the potential effects of a debt ceiling default. And let's talk about the fact that the government has been shut down for, what, 16 days? Are we on 16?
Day 16, I think.
There's my boy Van Jones on CNN. Did you see him dressing down Ted Cruz? One of the great moments.
There's a great clip circulating the internet on that.
Yeah, he was.
So there's really a much more fascinating discussion that you and I are not having.
Okay.
Which is
about sex.
what is happening
Drugs.
To the Republican Party?
Yeah.
And if we think about this, the coalition that we talked about earlier, fragmenting. I don't want to talk about politics. I don't want to talk about, are you a Democrat or Republican? Strategically, are the Republicans going to become the new Whigs? Remember, the Republican Party replaced the old Whigs, and the Whigs became a fringe party.
There's a lot of talk about there being a new
split,
a splitting the Republican Party into a moderate Republican conservatives and a far right.
Radical right. It's not even a moderate and a conservative. And it's a conservative and a radical.
So the Republican Party and the Tea Party.
That's right. So here's the fascinating.
And that when that happens in history, it's real bad for the party that divides because the other party stays unified. You get a Ross Perot effect.
That's exactly right. You end up with a situation. Look at this. It just goes to show you how unknowable the future is. When you had far right and far left groups rising, right? You had the Occupy Wall Street group come up and it kind of meandered off the reservation and more or less dissipated.
Whatever the hell that was.
And attenuated.
So
on the other hand, you had this far right group, the Tea Party, which I always looked at askance. They were upset. Remember the famous, who was the CNBC guy?
Santelli.
Rick Santelli went crazy. Why are we lending money to these moochers and these bums? And well, where was that outrage when we were giving trillions of dollars to banks and to Wall Street?
Well,
banks?
Those people work for it.
Not really. When
they
look
work
at,
hard. They work harder than
when
the
you look
moochers.
At the demographics of the Tea Party, they're not Wall Streeters. They don't live in New York City. They don't necessarily, but they do tend to be surprisingly higher educated, higher income, rural people who are just unhappy in concept with the federal government. So you have this philosophical debate within the Republican Party, which there was a fascinating article, I want to say in Slate, that pointed out that Fox News has created, and other right-wing outlets have created, this bubble that allows people on the far right to exist in this alternative universe that is somewhat detached from reality. And then they're unaware of this until they lose a major election. And despite getting fairly trounced in the 2012 election, not only nationally was it a landslide in Electoral College, but if you look at the House, Republicans lost the popular vote in the House.
You know, I John Avalon made that point yesterday, and I've heard that point made, I think, every day in Atlanta. And I want to defend Republicans on that and say that.
Well, you could argue cities have a higher population
More people voted for Democrats than Republicans in the congressional elections. But there's more people in the districts that vote for the Democrats. They're more likely urban, denser, constant. So the idea.
But is this? This is a new thing.
I don't think that's a great argument.
You did not have this 10 and 20 and 30 years ago, where the majority party had less votes in the popular election for the Congress.
Less people living in their districts.
No, listen. If anything, the population shift has favored the Republicans. People have moved to the Sun Belt. People have moved from the Northern. People have left Detroit. People are leaving California. So it's not that there's less.
I disagree with that.
Well, just go look at this. This is not a debate over opinion.
The population shift has also demographically, Hispanics have moved into America, into the Sun Belt.
That's absolutely true.
And so the Hispanic vote is overwhelmingly Democrat.
But that's not in
the
city. If you what you're talking
about.
Why
do you keep pointing at me? As a lot of, I just see your thick.
Jacques. So the bottom line is this dichotomy didn't exist.
All right, so but going back to the division within the Republican Party, to your larger point, what does it mean?
I think so my view as someone who grew up in a Republican household but was always somewhat, you know, progressive when it came to social issues, I look at the core Tea Party argument as way out of step with what most people believe. And the key to this is, look, you could ask people in a poll, do you like Obamacare? And you get a lot of people saying no. As Jimmy Kimmel showed, if you say, what do you prefer, the ACA?
Bullshit, though.
If you say, what do you prefer,
bullshit.
The ACA? Or
that's bullshit.
Just shows you how ignorant people are.
No, but
however,
not,
if you say to people.
Because it doesn't, because if you interview 100 people and put 10 idiots on TV,
right.
You're not using evidence here.
Okay,
that's a comedy show.
But here's,
I did that for CNN. So, I talked to a lot of idiots. I didn't put them on.
So, but here's the point I'm leading up to. If you say to people, do you think children should have health care covered?
Yeah.
Do you think insurance companies should be able to drop coverage?
Right.
Just because someone gets cancer.
If you tell them what it does,
right.
They overwhelmingly
75%.
The most important point about the approval-disapproval ratings of Obamacare
right.
is that people don't know what
And that's
it
Obama's
is.
Fault, but let's hold
no,
that
it's
argument
not Obama's
to somewhere
fault.
Else.
It is not Obama's fault.
He's done a terrible job
no, he
selling
has
this.
Not. No, he's
granted,
not.
There's a lot of misinformation
no, he's not. People
coming
need
from
one sentence, and he can only go out just so many times. If he goes out and says what it is, and then someone goes on the radio or on TV and says it's
socialism,
it's death panels,
it's
socialism,
the end of the world.
It's all I don't buy that he hasn't done a good enough job explaining it.
The
I
fact
don't.
That it's so unknown is, I think, prima facie evidence.
Part of the reason,
but let's hold that
part
aside.
Part of the reason why is that they won't allow any money being used to implement it, to educate people upon it, on it, and so on. I just,
but
I,
okay,
I hate
but
to be
all that
the
said,
so much, but
the point that I'm leading to is that this Obamacare is the death of America, is the social, is not widely when you. Go point by point.
Right. When
is
you explain
not,
what it does,
that is not a
it is
widely held view.
Overwhelmingly supported.
So now put this in
yes.
context of the schism within the Republican Party.
Right.
So the argument that they're making is that government is too big. We want smaller government. You speak to people. Do you want, not a general ambiguous question. Do you want bigger government or small government? Do you want to cut Medicaid? No. Do you want to cut Social Security? No. Do you want to close the national parks or privatize them? No. You go. List item after item that the government provides, the services government provides, the public overwhelmingly supports this. And
right.
so the key point that the Tea Party is forcing this issue upon the Republicans are that they're defending a point of view which is held by increasingly less people. Someone else wrote an article, and it might have been Ezra Klein at the Washington Post, but I'm not positive, which said the biggest fear the Republicans have is not that Obamacare becomes law. It already is law. The biggest
like
fear
it.
Is that people
well,
like
everybody
it.
Wrote
Wait,
that article.
You mean if I get fired, I don't lose my insurance? Yeah. That's awesome. And so how are they going to get the government down to a size you can drown in the bathtub, to quote Grover Norquist? I always think that's a Sesame Street character.
It is.
And
that's why. It's
and
not the Norquist part.
When people say... Oh, you mean being like Japan or Switzerland or Germany or England, where you don't have to worry about health insurance? The single medical cost, the single biggest cause of bankruptcy yeah. in the United States. Suddenly, you have to go back and rethink your core beliefs. And what you're watching now, and you'll notice I've given none of my views on this. I find the tactical and strategic debate within the Republican Party fascinating. Because you're watching a major party in a two-party system struggle to figure out what their identity is, what their soul is, and losing the battle with itself. It's unprecedented in modern times. We haven't seen anything like this in a century.
Listen to the following two tweets. Hoos Gow Flask. I feel like I need ADD meds listening to at Ritholtz and at Pete Dominic. Then Alex Philo 7. Stop interrupting.
Who's going to pay for those ADD meds? Is he on Obamacare in order to get the
Pete Dominic, stop interrupting Ritholtz. Let him talk. I mean, I can't please both these listeners. Because
no, I think you can please both them by listening to the second one.
But then if I let you just go,
yes,
sometimes you'll go off on a tangent, and that's
me?
When I interrupt.
Okay.
That's the only time.
So
let's
turn this into a question and answer format.
All right.
Start firing questions away, and I'll see if we can elucidate some wisdom on general subjects.
You had a big conference here last week, and it was really interesting because you welcomed people. You had speakers that talked not really about finance, but about success, about using
process and process, thinking and cognitive evidence, abilities.
Thinking.
We do that every year, by the way, the Big Picture Conference in October.
I get frustrated with listeners when, or it happened earlier today. Guy called in and I said, there aren't two sides of climate change. And he started arguing, well, 10 years ago, cyclical. I got,
never teach a pig to sing. I tell you that every time
I'm
here.
Here's the thing. I'll ask questions to my orthopedic surgeon before surgery. My daughter just had surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I asked
how's she doing?
She's great. I asked a whole bunch of questions on her arm, by the way, orthopedic. That's why I bring it up. There's nothing serious. I asked a whole bunch of questions. I did not, however, stand in the operating room and tell him how to do his job. I didn't go to medical school for 10 years. I'm not a climatologist. And so it's easy. People want to argue things, but I'm not interested in arguing really complex science, even though this isn't that complex. You get it. Greenhouse gases trap heat,
right.
Period. But
It's a great.
But the point is, this is what I'm describing this, the kind of Tea Party far right extremist as. Mm-hmm. They really have a lot of cognitive dissonance in that it doesn't matter how much evidence is presented to them. And liberals can be that way, of course, too, on a lot of things. But the idea that
the far right has really adapted that persona more than anything else, because they can live in a bubble. They can live in an echo chamber where. So I have a couple of rules of thumb.
Let me just finish. Their district, the way where they live, is very homogenous in its way of thinking.
Okay,
there's
that's
not a lot of diversity of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And people think generally the same thing. They go to the same churches. They work in similar industries. There's not a lot of people. Then they go on Facebook and post generally the same things. They listen to generally the same radio shows, watch generally the same television shows. Generally, there's tons of exceptions to this, but their thinking isn't challenged, which is why they're surprised when Romney lost, why they'd be surprised when the things that are predicted will happen if the debt ceiling isn't raised happens, and why they're surprised, why they don't agree with things that don't have two sides, like climate change and the moon isn't made of cheese and there's no magical guardian angels in heaven and hell. I mean, and that final religious point is that's another common trait, is that they're very religious, very, I'll argue, Christian. And Christians are taught by the nature of their religion not to question.
Right.
Where your people, the Jews, are taught to question. That's what they do. They sit around and question the Torah, the rabbis do. Whereas overwhelmingly in Christian religions, you are not. This is how
when
it
you've
is.
Been chased out of every country, you very quickly learn to question authority. Yeah. It's a natural.
And so I think there is some of that too. Now I'm really generalizing here. There's plenty of exceptions to this. You know, Ted Cruz is a Harvard educated dude, but he did just join a rally where one of the people at the rally.
Put down the Quran.
Said,
I love
said that
line.
The president should stop worshiping Allah and put down the Quran.
Right.
You know,
fantastic.
At the same group, you know.
It's a case study in cognitive dissonance. So. It's amazing. So the person you mentioned, by the way, at the conference is Professor Michael Mabuson of Columbia, who is actually also works for Credit Suisse. By coincidence, he's an American. He used to work at Legg Mason. But he has a book out which is on disentangling success and luck in investing, sports, and business. And the theme from that is a lot of what we think is conscious, willful results of smart decision-making turns out to be just serendipity, turns out to be luck. The way the world has worked in the internet era is that you end up with a group of people who have the ability to focus on and hear just what they want to hear.
Right.
This is true on the right and the left.
Yeah, but don't. Yeah, so the liberals do the same thing.
So the
Democrats,
liberals. But here's the difference. Here's the fascinating difference.
What's the difference?
So when we talk about press bias, we know that reporters tend to be left and editors tend to be right, and that we generally know that the higher education levels you have, the more likely your tendency is to be to the left of center versus the right of center. I'm not saying there's a causation there, but that's just how things have worked out over the years. Eric Alterman had a great book called What Liberal Media, and pointed out that all of the mainstream press in America is corporate owned. So the liberal bias of NBC, they're owned by GE.
Right.
And the liberal bias of
tax policy
is owned by Disney.
Subsidies.
And yeah. Right, you go through all this stuff, you've had an increasingly concentrated press owned by these big corporations and robber barons and others. And so what we talk about liberal bias is really much less liberal bias and much more, hey, these guys are working the ref and
so
trying to get the
But what's the
press
difference?
To,
you didn't answer the question with the difference between you're saying that, you know.
So this leads to the next step, which is the response to that was the was Rupert Murdoch buying a number of papers, buying the Wall Street Journal, putting out Fox Business News, fair and balanced, which actually turns out to be it's neither fair nor balanced. They're an arm of the Republican Party.
Right.
And instead of you look at the New York Times op-ed page, you have Paul Krugman on one end and you have David Brooks on the other, who replaced William Sapphire.
Hannity and Combs, sir.
No, Combs is not a real liberal.
He's a real liberal,
fake punching
but he's gone.
Bag.
Jason in D.C.
How you doing?
Hey, Jason.
Hey, quick question for you. You know, obviously, paper currencies on average only last about 42 years, I believe, was the latest statistic.
If you have any, by the way, anyone who has any paper dollars that they think are worthless, just send them to me and I'll dispose of them properly.
That's not my point. Eventually, you know, you're going to have to do something about the debt. And obviously, what is your solution for how we can bring the spending under control?
I have a great solution. It's really easy. Get people back to work.
That's oversimplification.
It's the unemployment.
If you want to get rid of the debt, and there's a group of folks who think that it's totally unnecessary,
right.
But let's argue for a moment that we want to get rid of the debt. The math is incredibly simple. You cut spending and raise taxes, and you eventually get rid of the debt. You look at what the biggest tax expenditures are, which in the United States is defense, Social Security, and Medicare, Medicaid. And you look at where all the biggest tax cuts have been, which have been corporate levels, individual at the top of the incoming and at the very bottom of the income pool. And you rejigger that to raise the amount of income coming in, and you rejigger the spending to reduce the amount of spending coming in. Look, Social Security is really
and you also take government investment and invest
and you improve into, the economy
well, you
in order to increase total
spending,
revenues. Yes.
The spending that you have should be on things that actually improve the economy. Now, defense
is the weakest.
The
ROI on defense is very low.
Spend on education. Spend on research at places like the NIH.
Right.
What else do you need to know, Jason?
So, well, the point you're trying to do is somehow you think that somebody's going to come along in the next 2 years and invent another Microsoft that'll make, you know.
No, no one's saying anything remotely like that.
What we're saying is you have to constantly reinvest
in the country.
No, but the return on your investment, the only thing you should be investing is something that creates efficiency. And a lot of
you have a point of view and you never want to hear anything else. And
okay,
you're spouting things. I just told you how to do the math. You raise the revenue, you cut the spending.
Spending on education improve efficiency?
You're trying to teach a pig to sing. I don't have patience for
this.
Well, I would say it should be done.
Basically,
on a
you
level.
Want to close the deficit, you cut the spending,
right.
You raise
the
taxes.
Number?
The
what's
math
the
on this is simple. Any accountant fresh out of college can tell you,
Barry,
well,
Barry,
you're taking in too little money and you're spending
too much
money.
He took his headphones off. He's
that's basically it. And this is the flat earth debate. This is the global warming debate. The math on this is really simple. What he's really saying is, I don't like the idea of government being 20-25% of the economy and spending on all these things. So let's figure out a way to slash this. And the only way we could do this is to slash it on the spending. We're not interested in taxes.
The goal is not to balance the budget.
The goal
Barry,
is to shrink the government.
How about a flat
and
tax?
That's a whole different
How about a flat
thing.
Tax?
How about a flat or a fair tax? Because, you know, when Apple's paying 9.8%
He's not listening. He took his headphones off.
You
cannot listen to the guy. Come on.
Why can't I?
All right. Randy in Iowa. I have to choose my guest over the listener, unfortunately.
Next subject.
Randy.
Hi, Randy. How's it going? From the land
well,
of ethanol, how are you?
I'm excellent. I've enjoyed your program, but you made a comment a little while ago about bankruptcies being caused by medical bills and that Obamacare may aid in that.
The theory is it can reduce it. We don't know if that'll happen, but that's the theory.
Yeah.
It absolutely will not happen. I had surgery a couple of years ago.
Before Obamacare, yes.
Before, yes. I paid my deductible and a small portion past that. My wife and I figured it up. If we would have had Obamacare, we would have paid $36,000 on that surgery as compared to the $3,000 I paid.
How did you and your wife figure it out?
We had the bills.
The bills?
We had the bills from my surgery.
Uh-huh.
And what we were told that we could expect with Obamacare, which was a
Who told you that? Really?
Our exchange. We got some information from the Iowa exchange.
Well, that's good.
It was darn little, but we got some.
Well, you're taking one specific example, and I can't respond to that, but here's the math. The math is that you have 50 million people in America who have no health insurance, unlike most industrialized nations. And when you look at those people when they have a sudden and unanticipated medical circumstance, look at what happened with your kid.
Yep.
That's probably $20,000 or $30,000 out of pocket. Right. You're not going to tell your kid they're not going to get surgery.
It's simpler than that. If you don't, the leading cause for bankruptcy in America, Randy, is what?
Oh, it's medical bills.
Right.
I understand.
So, let's say that you're right and that your medical, you're going to have to pay more under this. And I don't think you are.
He should get on the phone with some people from the Iowa legislature and make sure that Medicaid actually applies.
He should go to the Kaiser calculator and use that as well. But Randy, the truth is, if everybody's covered, there's going to be far less people that are going to actually have no coverage and hence not lose entire livelihood.
I will agree with you to a point.
Okay.
Hold on. Let me
finish. What, Randy?
How many of those millions of people will get a cut rate because they can't afford the full-blown premium?
It depends on what state they're in. If you're in a state that's rejected the Medicare, Medicaid funding,
Medicaid expansion,
you're going to have far more out-of-pocket expenses than the guy in the next state whose governor accepted it.
Even though you're paying for it.
Even though you're paying
your state
for it.
Exactly.
So you guys need to talk to your local governors and state legislature.
I believe
and tell
Iowa
them,
took the Medicaid expansion.
Did they?
Believe,
oh,
I
so
believe.
It.
I believe they did.
I'll have to take a look and have him send something in to Alfred afterwards.
To Alfred.
Somebody contact him. Hang on the line. We'll get
send
an email.
Send an email to me, standupwithpete@gmail.com. Randy.
And we'll do a quick review
and
see how
that did. I'm sorry you
didn't
listen to Jason.
What?
I'm sorry you took your headphones off and didn't listen to Jason.
Why?
You got really flabbergasted with him.
Because I refuse to try and teach pigs to sing because it wastes my time and annoys the pig. Mm-hmm. This guy doesn't care about reducing the deficit. That's a red herring. That's a canard. What he is arguing for, and indeed what the Tea Party is essentially arguing for, is a much smaller government. That's the philosophical underpinning.
On your argument that the media is owned by corporations, NBC, this guy writes, Pete, GE does not own NBC anymore. Comcast.
Actually, they spun it out. Right.
So
it's now.
But the point is, the point that you made is still pretty.
It's
even more accurate.
NBC, when Eric wrote that book, GE owned NBC.
Right.
NBC has gotten tossed around.
But the point is, they're still corporate owned. Even
that's
bigger.
Right.
All right, we're out of time. Thank you very much, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Stay tuned for the replay and more. Bye bye.